Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. And welcome back to New Books in Sports, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Dr. Jorge Red of Texas Tech University, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Ron Snyder regarding his new book, The Baltimore Stallions, The Brief Brilliant History of the CFL Champion Franchise, which is out on McFarland Books in 2020. Ron, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Good. Well, listen, before we get started discussing this really interesting book, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, thanks again for having me. I've been in the media industry for about 20 years now. I've worked in newspapers, television, digital publications, and media relations. I've also been an adjunct professor at Towson University, teaching a variety of mass communication courses. Again, throughout the course of my career, I've been blessed to be able to cover a little bit of everything from politics and community news to sports, which has kind of led me to this passion of being able to write books like I've currently been doing the last several years.
Okay, good, good. How did you come to write this particular book?
Well, this is a book that I've wanted to write for about 10 years now. You know, it's a unique story, one that, you know, is regional in nature, but also has a multinational reach. If you consider the fact, again, this is about a Canadian Football League team making its presence known in the United States. You know, I grew up a football fan here in Baltimore, and I was 5 years old when the Colts left town, and I was about 18 when the Ravens arrived. So, you know, I kind of had a childhood without football. Professional football as a team, and you know, this team came in and really kind of captured our hearts for the brief time they were there. It was very unique in the fact that they, you know, won, played in the championship game both years, you know, the Grey Cup, and they won it all in their last year. And it just as quickly as they were here, they were gone. The Ravens come to town, the NFL kind of said we're coming back to Baltimore, and they're just, you know, the CFL experiment in the U.S. just wasn't working overall, and if it wasn't going to work in Baltimore, it wasn't working anywhere. And so they ended up moving to Montreal. And, you know, I always felt like, man, it had such a great story, you know, highs, lows, the thrill of victory, agony of defeat, you know, everything that you want in a great sports story. and I always just wanted an outlet to be able to tell it.
Okay. Okay. Let's turn to the book itself. And again, I found this book absolutely fascinating because of the fact that this is, I believe I'm correct when I say that this is the only U.S.-based team ever to win a Grey Cup championship, correct?
That is correct. Yeah. So that makes it very unique in that regard.
Okay. So in your introduction, and I think one of the really good things about the book, in addition to telling the story of the Stallions, is that you really do spend quite a bit of time covering the history of professional football in Baltimore. So let me start with that. In your introduction, you mentioned that the Stallions arrived in Baltimore at an opportune time. What do you mean by opportune time, and why was Baltimore ready to accept a CFL franchise in 1994?
Well, really, it's again, it kind of came at a time where I don't think it would have worked before or after. You got to think at that point in time, again, Baltimore was without an NFL team. They had attempted several times to lure an existing team here. There was talk about the Cardinals coming and the Bucks, and even some minor discussions about the Raiders, among others. The city also had just lost out to expansion. They had some great ownership teams in place, but the NFL first went to Charlotte, which I think everyone understood was a new market. But then they went to Jacksonville, and that kind of really made people scratch their head why Jacksonville. It just didn't seem to fit. And I think at that point in time, it had been a decade since there had been no football. And I think the fans in Baltimore were just tired of being the punching bag of the NFL. They were ready for something different. They were ready to move on. You enter Jim Spiros, the owner, the businessman who brought the team into town. And I think they were just ready to say, we don't need you, NFL. We're gonna embrace this team, and we're going to celebrate football like Baltimore knows how to. Again, it's a city that with a deep history. To many, the NFL was put on the map thanks to Baltimore in the 1958 championship game between the Colts and the Giants, which was called the greatest game ever played.
Right. Right. And in chapter one, you actually go into that particular history. You discuss the history of the Colts starting in 1947. Now, initially, the Colts struggle when they were part of the old All-American Football Conference and also in their first year in the NFL. Why was the city supportive of this version of the franchise, even though they were not very successful on the field?
Well, I think it was one of those things where the city wasn't quite ready to embrace football, professional football. Again, think of that time, baseball, boxing, horse racing were really the kings of sports at that point in time. And football, college football was huge in many parts of the country. It's like it still is today. But the NFL was still a regional secondary sport in many ways. Again, it really took several years before it was ready to grow. So, I think it was just a couple years too early, but one that the city was ready to embrace them shortly thereafter.
Okay. How does Carol Rosenblum get involved with the Colts and bring the Colts back to Baltimore? Tell us a little bit about that part of the story.
Well, the Colts came up from the ashes of the former Dallas Texans. And Bert Bell, who's the commissioner, was also a coach in college. I was one of Carol Rosenblum's coach when he played football at University of Pennsylvania. And Carol had gone on to make considerable money in garment industry and was well known in Baltimore. And the league was looking to expand or relocate to Baltimore. And I think that connection kind of led to Rosenblum kind of being encouraged to join the league, and it kind of took off from there.
Okay. We're not going to have to talk about something that's very unpleasant, obviously, for people from Baltimore and any of these Baltimore Colt fans. In chapter two, you describe the Colts leaving for Indianapolis in 1984. Tell us a little bit about what that was like for the fans of the city? Now, again, you were fairly young at the time, but, you know, what was it like as you were growing up? What were some of the stories that you heard from some other folks in your family, some of your friends who maybe had been longtime Colts fans and saw this team just literally drive away in the middle of the night in moving vans in 1984?
Well, really, my only memory of the Colts as a child, anyway, was those moving vans leaving. And I think, you know, we were all optimistic, though, that the NFL is not going to let this happen. You know, they may take them, but we're going to get a team right away, or they're going to reverse it and make them sell the team and we'll get the Colts back. They're not going to let the city that was home to Johnny Unitas and Raymond Berry and Lenny Moore and Burt Jones and so many great players who just not have a franchise. And at that point, I mean, the Colts were a shell of the former selves. You know, Robert Irsay had ran the franchise into the ground. You know, he never wanted, from the time he traded franchises with Carol Rosenbloom in the 70s, you know, it was pretty obvious, you know, in hindsight, that he had no intentions of keeping the team in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And he did everything he could to, you know, to make that happen. You know, at that point, you know, I think the city was just kind of, you know, felt like it got hit with a Mack truck as far as sports goes. And they weren't, I don't know if we were really quantified exactly what it meant, but it led to a dark period of sports in Baltimore. I mean, you know, the Orioles were coming off of a World Series win in 83, but it was a franchise that would be quickly going down a dark path in and of itself as far as, you know, wins and losses on the field. So, you know, it really went from Baltimore, went from, you know, the highs of the late 60s, early 70s to being a World Series and Super Bowl champion city to being a team with one sport, and was wondering if, you know, even then at that point there was concern that the Orioles might leave town at the same time.
Let me ask you another aspect of this. And, you know, when the Cleveland Browns left to become the Baltimore Ravens, ironically enough, the city managed to keep the name and the records of the Browns in Cleveland. Was there any talk about doing something along those lines when the Colts left for Indianapolis? In other words, you were going to keep the Colts name and or at least the records, the franchise records, in Baltimore, as opposed to having those be now Indianapolis Colts records?
There was hope that that was the case, you know, in Baltimore. But again, it never panned out. The only thing that the city was really able to keep in the end was the marching band and the uniforms, and that was simply because the marching band happened to have taken the uniforms to the cleaners and kind of just hit them until, you know, the franchise said, oh, that's fine, you can keep them, don't worry about it.
Okay. Now, obviously the folks in Baltimore wanted to get another NFL team. But before that, you also had, before the Stallions come into the picture, the city actually has another franchise, and actually another very good franchise. And that happened to be the Philadelphia / Baltimore Stars of the USFL. What was the impact of that particular team on the city's fan base? I mean, did they embrace the Stars? What were some of the problems or what some of the issues in regards to the Stars in the USFL?
Yeah, in many ways, the Baltimore Stars were Baltimore in name only. You know, Philadelphia Stars franchise was really the premier franchise in the USFL. You know, had played in the championships, you know, all 3 years of league existence, winning it two of the last 3 years. But, you know, there was an owner, that, you know, that really pushed the league to try to move to the fall. And, you know, I heard that owner got into politics.
That person's name escapes me now for some reason.
You know, but this isn't a political show, so we'll let people figure that out for themselves.
That's correct.
When that happened, the Philly was the Philly franchise was really left without a home, and there was a desire to move to Baltimore. But at that point in time, the Orioles were the lone occupants of a Memorial Stadium, which had shared the stadium with the Colts for many years. But a franchise couldn't play there until 1986, when they were technically moved to the Fall. Obviously, the league never made it that far. But in the meantime, they decided to play at College Park, the University of Maryland's stadium. But they still practiced in Philly. So they practiced in Philly. They played in College Park, which is, for those who don't know, is right outside of D.C. It might be 30 minutes away, but in many regards, it could be might as well be 2 hours away from Baltimore. Very different markets. And a lot of people didn't want to make that drive down there. So they were called the Baltimore Stars, but really they played in Philly. They played in College Park and they practiced in Philly. Again, the local media did cover them. There was obviously beat writers at the Baltimore Sun. It was picked up on local broadcasts, on local radio stations as well. But again, they were only there for the 1 year, so it really wasn't really much to embrace at that point.
Okay. So the Stars go away. Obviously the entire USFL goes away. Tell us a little bit, and you describe this, I think, very nicely in Chapter 4. Tell us a little bit about how the city of Baltimore then goes into this period where they are trying to woo the NFL to come back to Baltimore. Tell us a little bit about that, and tell us a little bit maybe about the frustrations that come about because of that being spurned by the NFL repeatedly.
Well, I mean, it kind of starts with the governor at the time, William Donald Schaefer. William Donald Schaefer was the mayor of Baltimore when the Colts left, and he took it very personally that the Colts left town on his watch, and he really wanted to work to bring that franchise back to Baltimore. There was funding in place through the lottery association, the lottery, where a portion of the lottery funds here in Maryland were, utilized for a stadium package. There was a push to try to, bring several franchises in. Most notably was the Cardinals, but the Bidwells like the weather more in Arizona. And then after that, the league announced that it was going to expand. So the city and the state pushed really hard to find quality, owners, and had several in place, Boogie Wineglass, the Lerner family, among others, try to bring a franchise in. And again, the first one went to Charlotte. And I think a lot of people kind of understood that because it was a new market. Charlotte was growing. The Hornets had been pretty successful up to that point in the NBA.
Right.
They figured, okay, well, the next one's going to go to maybe St. Louis, who had lost the Cardinals. Maybe Memphis, that had success in the USFL as well. But or in Baltimore. And then when it went to Jacksonville, people were just like, dumbfounded. They couldn't understand why. And Paul Tagliabue, the commissioner of the NFL, famously told us, maybe we should take that money and build a museum. And that kind of made people even madder. And we're just kind of wondering, are we ever going to be an NFL city again?
And of course, I think the NFL really, as a Floridian, native Floridian, the Jacksonville Jaguars are just an absolute joke. It really has been not exactly the most successful franchise. I mean, they're even talking possibly about moving them to London.
Right. Before all this, obviously, before the pandemic and everything. I think that the thought was initially was to kind of tap into the Orlando market. The Magic, and looking at the NBA, the Magic had done well. At that point, they had Shaq coming in for the Magic, and they were really popular. And the thought was you know, that Jacksonville's not too far from Florida, you know, from Orlando, maybe tap into that market, but it never really panned out that way.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Now, all right, so we've been talking a lot about the history of Baltimore and professional football, the city being spurned by the Colts, and then the issue with the Stars, and now the frustration with the NFL not coming back to the city. In chapters 5 through 9, you examined the birth of the Stallions, initially called the CFL Colts, and then there was an issue with that. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that history and how the people of Baltimore reacted to the CFL Colts or the CFLers or eventually the Stallion?
So again, you know, the idea was to really kind of capitalize on the anger that the NFL had created in Baltimore. And it came at the same time that the CFL was expanding into the U.S. The CFL was looking to add franchises, in part to try to take advantage of the U.S. market, while also trying to get an influx of cash from expansion fees. Jim Spiros was a former college football player and a businessman who thought that this was a good opportunity. When he came into town, he was a great salesman, connected with Tom Matty, a former Colt, several businessmen in the area to kind of tap into some of that local flavor and open some doors in that regard. His thought was that, look, if we're going to name this team, there's only one thing you can name it. It's the Baltimore CFL Colts. And that kind of energized the fan base even more, and people started buying season tickets. But then the league and the Colts, the Indianapolis Colts, had sued over the copyright infringement. They fought it the best they could, getting a lot of pro bono legal help. At the end of the day, the CFL Colts, there was a an injunction right before the start of the season. So, they had to literally black everything out that included the word Colts. So they played the first season without a name. They were just the Baltimore CFLers of the Baltimore CFL football team. Some fans of a certain Washington team can kind of relate to what it's like.
I guess so.
You kind of want to put it in context in today's world. You saw what happened with the team in Washington without a name.
Right.
But, just because, they couldn't call themselves the Colts didn't mean that the fans in the stands couldn't, utilize that nickname. They would call each other, the announcer would say, you're Baltimore CFL, and it'd be Colts chants, and there's C-O-L-T-S in the stand. And they really tried to bring back that feeling from the 60s and 70s.
Let me ask you this. Now, you said that was there actual merchandise produced that actually had the logo or the name on it that said CFL Colts?
There were hats and mugs and shirts and programs, and the football field had Colts on it. I have some, I have a hat and some programs and some other stuff that says, Baltimore CFL Colts at home.
I would assume that stuff is highly valued in the Baltimore area even to this day.
To a group following. I don't know how much it's worth, but from a financial perspective, but it definitely has a special place in the hearts of those fans that could appreciate what's going on here in Baltimore. But they literally had to take Sharpies and go through all the programs and all the hats and all of everything that said Colton Lurie paint over the field right before the first game. So that was kind of unique in and of itself. And again, because of the uniqueness of all of this, it became the lead story, not just, you know, locally, but you know, nationally. It was the lead story in ESPN, Washington Post, New York Times, you know, CNN, you know, all of the national outlets was covering this team and this battle.
Now, how did the folks in Baltimore react? I mean, it was professional football, right? That's true, but it's a different type of professional football. How did the folks in Baltimore react to seeing a Canadian Football League product on the field, with the difference in the size of the field, the rouge, the all that wacky motion that takes place before the start of before the ball is snapped, in addition to the fact that you only get two downs to get your 10 yards. How did the folks react to those differences?
Well, you know, it was a little different back then. Obviously, this was really before the internet, so there wasn't a whole lot of being able to kind of just go on Google and track all this stuff down. So they really had to learn on the fly, and there was educational campaigns for the team and the league. You know, I think really the only thing that I knew about the CFL was that, you know, Doug Flutie had played there, or was still there at that point in time. Warren Moon had played there. And we kind of knew Rocket Ishmael had been with the Argonauts a couple of years prior. And right. You know, we knew about Pinball Clemens, who was, you know, there's still one of the all-time greats that was there at the time. But I think for us, you know, for us in Baltimore, it was football, and you know, we're going to figure out the rules. But you know, these were blue collar players who weren't making a lot of money. They were, you know, and it was, so we could kind of relate. It was kind of like a going back to the past, because you know, these, like, much like Johnny Unitas and Art Donovan and Raymond Barry, you know, they lived in the same neighborhoods as we did. So did these guys. These guys lived in the same apartment buildings. Their kids went to the same schools. You know, they shopped at the same grocery store. So, you know, it was very much a, you know, a connection in that regard.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I mean, that really has been such a special part of the history of the Colts, the sort of the blue collar aspect of the various players and the blue collar aspect of the team as a whole in relation to the city.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something that we even to this day, you know, people in Baltimore, you know, appreciate is that, again, we've always had this, you know, justly or unjustly, this inferiority complex, or we're just a stop between Washington and Philadelphia. We're not a major, you know, people don't think of us as a major city, and, you know, we kind of use that as a rallying point, and our blue collar players is something that we use to attach that argument moving forward.
Okay. All right. So let's get to the action on the field, and let's talk a little bit about that. In chapters 10 through 12, you examine the Stallions, CFLers/Stallions seasons in Baltimore. Tell us a little bit about those two seasons, and again, the fan reaction, where people actually, because I mean, the story of the CFL US-based franchises, you know, is pretty well known. It was basically an unmitigated disaster. Tell us a little bit about the seasons, and tell us a little bit about whether Baltimore was different in regards to the success as far as attracting fans to the stands, unlike, you know, some of the other franchises that existed, the Las Vegas Posse or some of those teams.
Right, and you're right. In many cases, you know, the franchises were an unmitigated disaster. Las Vegas was probably the biggest example of that. But in Baltimore, you know, again, I think a combination of, you know, desire for football, anger at the NFL, and then also, this was also, especially the first season, 94, I gotta remember there was a baseball strike. So, you know, there was no Orioles. So really, you know, if you wanted professional sports in Baltimore, that was it. So they got a lot more attention than they would have had otherwise, just given all of those factors in play. And they didn't go through the path of hiring, you know, former NFL coaches or former, you know, name players that many of the other franchises did. They went after CFL coaches. They went after CFL player personnel people, and really put a roster together of people that had success in the CFL, and it led to success on the field. Also another thing that people may not know is that the CFL requires so many of their players to be born in Canada, citizens of Canada. U.S. rules, those rules didn't apply to the U.S. teams because of labor laws here in the U.S. So they had a little bit of a competitive advantage in that regard because they could go and get whoever they wanted. And the first year, I mean, they jumped out and had a really good season. They went 12-6. And was second in their division, and they made it all the way to the Grey Cup, and lost to the BC Lions on a last second field goal in what was many considered one of the great Grey Cups of all times. And then after that, they went on to win the Grey Cup the next year.
Tell us a little bit more about that second season. I believe the team didn't start off particularly well. How did that season play out? And I think really also one of the things that I think our listeners would want to know is how many people are coming to these games.
Well, again, you know, the first season the team averaged over 30,000 fans a game. Both seasons they averaged more than 30,000 fans. Led the league in attendance the first year. I was second in the league in attendance second year. Just by comparison, you think about the XFL, which, you know, was starting to pick up a little bit of steam this year before the pandemic. They were happy with, you know, 15,000-20,000 fans. So, you know, imagine getting 35,000-40,000 fans to a CFL game in Baltimore. And because I think the success on the field, you know, that helped as well. The novelty of just being a, you know, new team and being able to stick it to the NFL would have wore off pretty quickly if the team hadn't been any good. So the fact that they played for a title and brought back everyone the next year, added to the legacy and the legend of this team. In the second season, the mantra was really unfinished business. And the goal was to go all the way. They had a little bit of up and down season early on that second season, in part because, again, remember, they play with a 36-man roster and not a 53-man roster like the NFL does. And because of the way the scheduling worked, because of, you know, where the franchises were in places like not just, you know, Edmonton and Calgary and Toronto, but, you know, San Antonio, Baltimore, Birmingham, Memphis, Shreveport, among others, led to some weird travel arrangements. And at one point, the Stallions, again, at that point, they had renamed themselves the Stallions in that second season because of having lost the lawsuit. They figured they had to find a name, so they kept, you know, the horse name went with the Stallions. They at one point had to play something like 4 games in like 13 days, which is unheard of, you know, for football.
Right.
And, you know, the Ravens or the Cowboys or what have you, having that many games with 20 fewer players on its roster. So they were wore out. They had lost a couple games during that stretch. But once they got through that, they didn't lose again and took it all the way to the Grey Cup.
Who did they play in that particular Grey Cup, and what was the final score?
That year they played the Calgary Stampeders.
Doug Flutie.
Doug Flutie. Yeah. And the other quarterback for that team was Jeff Garcia. It's two, you know, very high quality NFL quarterbacks. That year it was a pretty dominating game. The Stallions, you know, in Saskatchewan in one of the coldest games you can imagine, won 37-20. So it was a dominating game. They became the only American franchise to ever win the Grey Cup.
Excellent. What was the reaction of the city when the team came back from Saskatchewan with the Grey Cup?
You know, we have to back up a little bit because 2 weeks prior, they're getting ready to play in the conference championship. The number one seed, the Rocket and Rolling, November early November, the Art Modell announces that the Browns are leaving Cleveland and they're coming to Baltimore. So mm-hmm. with that came, obviously lots of news and, the media just kind of had to cover that story. So a lot of the resources went away. The interest by the fans cut back because, again, it was kind of like I used the analogy of, a jilted boyfriend or girlfriend. They get cheated on, get treated really poorly. And so they go and find this nice, young lady or young man, be in a relationship with, and then the one that cheats on him calls back and says, "I'm sorry, I've changed. Will you take me back?" And then they decide to go back to him and leave the new spouse or companion did nothing wrong, but they just decided to give it another shot, and that's what happened with the Stallion.
Do you think that the Stallion's success on the field and the fact that they were the most successful of these American-based franchises in the CFL, did that help to attract the attention of Art Modell and the NFL, or was this, were there other things going on in the background?
I think there were those who believe that was an overriding factor. But in the end of the day, it was a factor, but it wasn't, I wouldn't say it was, it wasn't the main factor. There was a great stadium deal in place. Cleveland was looking to move, and there wasn't a whole lot of options at that point in time. Again, the fact that they were able to put 40,000 fans in a CFL game there helped. I think it may have been the icing on the cake, but it wasn't the ultimate factor. But I think it's okay factor.
Okay. All right. So now the Ravens have announced, or the Browns have announced, that they're going to move to Baltimore. Tell us, I guess, about the death throes of the Stallions, a team that has just won the Grey Cup, that has been the most successful U.S.-based CFL franchise, and now all of a sudden they've got a major problem. Yeah. How do they deal with that?
I mean, at this point, the U.S. expansion of the CFL was teetering on disaster. Baltimore's really the linchpin that kept everything together. And look, Baltimore is a major sports town, but it's not New York. It's not Los Angeles. It's not Miami. There's only so many ad dollars and marketing dollars that go around. And there was just no way the city would be able to support two professional football teams here in town. And so, they tried to make it work. They tried to looking at other options as far as maybe moving to Virginia or Houston or any one of a number of things. But, a lot of the CFL, most of the majority of the CFL franchises were folding up at that point. And, there just wasn't really anywhere left to go. But it was a solid franchise. So, they did work out a deal where, the Stallions were folded, but then moved up to Montreal and became the Alouettes. So, in many ways, this was a franchise that brought football back to Baltimore and then brought football back to Montreal.
So I guess in that regard, it is truly a unique franchise in that it helped to bring back professional football to two cities that had basically been spurned by their respective leagues.
Yeah, absolutely. And, Montreal went on to, for several years, be one of the model franchises in the CFL. Now, they had to divide up some of those, their roster, because, they couldn't all go to Montreal because of the Canadian role, a Canadian player role. But, a good foundation, including Jim Popp, the general manager, went to Montreal. Several people ended up in Toronto and some of the other franchises. But they were going to win several Grey Cups and play in several others, based in part because of the foundation that was laid by the Stallions core that moved up there.
I guess really the one last thing that I wanted to ask you about this is, does the arrival of the Ravens, and I mean, it's a successful franchise. Everyone is happy that the Ravens have done as well as they have. But how do the Ravens connect with the Colts as far as the passion and the love and the history of the fans of the city of Baltimore?
Well, I mean, I think they understood. They came in and they saw how the Stallions embraced the Baltimore's past, and they've always done a great job of connecting Baltimore's past with its present and its future. You know, they had always welcomed the old Colts to the stadium. You know, Johnny Unitas was there the first time the Colts on the sidelines, first time the Colts came to town, and you know, Jim Harbaugh was the quarterback for the Ravens, handed the ball off to Johnny Unitas. You know, all the Colts were on the sidelines for that first game in Baltimore '96. Lenny Moore, you know, has always been welcome to practice. So they've always embraced, embraced footballs, the Baltimore football past.
What's the understanding of the folks in Baltimore of the irony that they lost a team and they, you know, a great city with a great football tradition lost a team to Indianapolis, but then Baltimore was the beneficiary of a very similar situation that tore the heart out of the people of Cleveland. Is there any understanding of that irony in the city of Baltimore?
Initially there was. I mean, I think there still is, you know, a group of older fans today that, you know, a very small minority of fans that refused to embrace the Ravens because, you know, they arrived here the same way that the Colts arrived in Indianapolis and felt it was hypocritical. But if you look at the difference, when the Browns left, they left their history, they left their colors. They were guaranteed a franchise within, you know, 3 years. So they knew that this was temporary. Baltimore went a decade and not knowing whether there was going to be a, you know, another football team in town. So it was different in many regards, but at the same time, you know, I think the fans wanted to do everything they could to get an expansion team. And really the NFL didn't leave many options. If we were going to get football back in Baltimore, it was going to be an existing franchise.
Okay. Ron, I think, you know, we've covered all the questions I wanted to ask. Is there any aspect of the Stallions' history that we have not discussed that you feel needs to be touched on?
Well, I think it's important if you look at it, the legacy of the team goes far beyond the 2 years here in Baltimore. Again, you look at that roster, you know, the greatest running back in CFL history, Mike Pringle, got his true start in Baltimore. The greatest GM, arguably, in CFL history, Jim Popp, started here in Baltimore. You know, Tracy Ham, the quarterback of the team, was a CFL Hall of Famer. Alfred Payton, whose son plays in the NBA, you know, Hall of Fame defensive player. You know, that team led several people to NFL careers. O.J. Brigant, who has battled ALS here so valiantly for more than a decade, ended up playing for the Ravens here in Baltimore, won a Super Bowl, was the only player in NFL history and in football history to win a Grey Cup and a Super Bowl ring in the same city. You know, Josh Miller, the punter, went on to win a Super Bowl ring with the Patriots. Several other players got, you know, ended up on NFL rosters. You know, there are executives on, you know, in sports franchises that got their start as interns with the Stallions. You know, then there's also, you know, we didn't even mention the band, you know, the Colts marching band, that had kept the fight for football here in Baltimore going through all those years that there wasn't a team. You know, was, you know, the band for the Stallions. And then when the band, when the Ravens arrived, they became the Ravens marching band. So, you know, the Stallions were really a bridge. I use that analogy. It provided a bridge between the Colts and the Ravens. and it really helped prepare Baltimore to be an NFL city again.
Well, let me, you know, I just thought of one other quick question that I wanted to ask you. The band is now called the Ravens Band. Do they ever, you know, every so often do they wear or come out in the old uniform, the old Colt uniforms? Is that maybe part of their repertoire?
They've got new uniforms now, although they did rework the fight song several years ago, the old Colts fight song, to modernize it a little bit to make it the Ravens fight song. So they reworked the lyrics, but you know the same marching, the same fight song that the Colts had for years is the fight song here in Baltimore.
Okay. Well, Ron, we've taken up a quite a bit of your time. This is a really, really great book. I just want to congratulate you on the work. You know, the idea of fans being spurned by professional teams is such an interesting story, and the role that new team that maybe comes in and sort of tries to fill that gap. It's just an absolutely fascinating story. So I really enjoyed reading the book, and I want to thank you for taking the time to visit with us today.
No, thank you. Again, it's available through McFarland Publishing. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it at Barnes & Noble or wherever books are sold. So,
okay. Well, thank you very much, and you have a good day.
You do the same. Thanks so much.